Colonel Featherby, Real 4. We were talking about the organisation of the battery and the gun position officer and everything. What would the gun position officer have as his personal vehicle?
Well, the command post would be set up in the back of either a 1500 weight with an extension out of the back with canvas on tubular steel things. In those days it would have been a three tonner with the tables and wireless set all set up in the inside of the tilt at the back.
So you just drove around in the lorry?
Yeah, that's right.
Would you have jeeps and things as well?
Yes, well, the OP parties would have had jeeps, and the battery commander would have had a jeep or the equivalent, because we eventually got Champs, which is that funny Austin vehicle which the army produced.
Now, as a gun position officer, would you be given experience at observation post party duty, observation party duty, or would that be a specialist job that was just...
No, I mean, it's the responsibility of every gun officer to be able to fire the guns, and therefore he would have been trained not only in the duties of a gun position officer or a command post officer, but also to actually fire the guns and observe the fall of shot and correct the fall of shot, and then get the guns to correct and fire again. So it would, on a camp, we would have probably one or two batteries actually firing the guns, and the third battery's officers would be doing the firing, and then we'd change around.
And can you just describe the procedure of ranging then, and possibly the fire orders, if you recall, because we didn't actually cover that in training, which is my fault, I've got to ask.
The usual procedure in training would be for a regular instructor in gunnery, wearing his official red hat, to be at the OP, and he would be in charge of training. He would point out on the range a target for you. You would then, in the days of the zero lines, you would take a bearing to the target from where you were sitting, and you would then convert that bearing into a bearing from the gun to the target, and you would give it that out as a switch, left or right, from your zero line. That particular system finished about the middle of the 1950s, and we then went on to grid references.
We'll come back. So you gave out the angle from the zero line. Plus,
yeah.
What about the actual mechanics of the giving the range or estimating the range and bracketing? If you know, we're still using bracketing.
Range was calculated by the OP and given to the gun position officer, and he would plot it on his artillery board and then work out the actual angles that the guns have to bear to an aiming point in order that all the four guns, or eight guns if it was a battery, pointed at the target. And he would give the individual guns the information which they then put on the dial sight and the range cone, and the gun was elevated to the range and on the switch. And he would then report that he was ready to fire. And he would then range with one gun, but all the other guns would follow the angles. And he would then, you could range with, well, you know, being a bit too technical. Well, you range with one gun. And when you saw the fall of shot, if it was on a zero line basis, you would say left 3 degrees. If it was on a grid reference type of correction, you would say drop 800 or add 800 or go right 400 or go left 400. And eventually, you would get around near the target or on the target. And then, because all the guns had followed that information, you could then get a whole lot to fire, or you could get them to fire individually to make sure that there wasn't one that was wrong.
So that's what the OP role was.
Yes.
And each officer, or certainly junior officer, would be given a turn at camp of doing this.
So with the senior sergeants as well, who were acting as surveyors.
Now, what about drill night training? What sort of thing would you do on a drill night?
Well, the drivers would maintain the vehicles, or if it was a reasonable night, they'd probably drive round and drive back again. The signals would do wireless training, setting up the wireless, getting on the net, speaking to one another, probably from two different classrooms, and the surveyors, as we call those that work the artillery boards and the technicals, that would be doing either artillery board drill or working out corrections for the Met, the weather conditions, and the gunners would probably be doing gun drill on a 25-5 square pad.
So just practicing loading, yeah. And would the layer be able to practice indoors? Wouldn't they?
Yeah, you can do it. Yes, you can set up an artificial aiming point for the sights, and get the yes, you can do it. Yeah.
Was an interest in people learning more than one trade, or which certainly was the wartime thing, that everybody would be encouraged to learn more than one thing, you know.
Yes, it wasn't commonplace. No.
So mostly if you were a signaller, that was what you'd do. You wouldn't learn how to use the guns.
Stay in that trade, yeah.
What about the quality of recruits you were getting, the origin and quality of recruits you were getting in the TA in
49-50? I don't really think they've changed dramatically over the years.
What about the origins? I mean, were you getting, were there still a high proportion of ex-servicemen, Second World War
yes.
types who'd rejoined?
Yes. There were always a fair, in those days there was a fair number, I would say something, I don't know, I suppose 25% of them were ex-servicemen, and the rest would be youngsters.
And the youngsters, where would you look to get them from? And what made the best material, or was it all much?
Well, you actually, generally speaking, I spent a lot of time going out with a gun and a vehicle and a command post and standing on at the marketplace in Nottingham, trying to persuade people to join us. I mean, we used to have recruiting drives and we used to go out to fates.
Had that started in 49-50 or was that a later thing?
It started in the 50s, yes, yeah.
I think I'll come back to that side of recruitment. What about, did you get any national servicemen join? Because didn't they have to, their last bid?
National servicemen had to serve a period of time in the Territorial Army. And I think it was for about 3 years they had to do an annual camp and a certain number of drill nights. They were good value, generally speaking, because they were trained.
And they were keen.
Yeah.
Did you get any of them to join up? I mean, when they finished what they had to do,
yes.
did they join up?
Yeah. Particularly if they achieved some kind of rank in the period that they were serving with us. They became a bombardier at the end of the time, they'd probably stay on with us.
Now, Peter Birkin's period came to an end in 49-50 or something, and Colonel Warburton took over, Arthur Warburton. And how did you feel about, you were still with 426 Battery, I presume?
Yes, I think I was then, yeah.
Could you talk us a bit generally about, you know, each colonel as we come to them? What about Colonel Warburton as a colonel and as a man? And, you know, what did you think?
He's a more flamboyant character in many ways. I mean, I've seen him actually, because he was an Essex yeoman, I mean, he got a very good war record at Arthur Warburton. You know. To be fair, you're going back, when I was a second lieutenant or a lieutenant, and he was the CO, so he was gone, and I was down here somewhere. So one didn't get to know him terribly well until much later on, when he was my honorary colonel, and we had the problem about the reformation of the regiment. But he was good. He was technically excellent, and he could. I mean, one of the things about a CO is his ability. I mean, the CO's job is different from anybody else's in the regiment, because you don't see him when he's actually at war. He's with the infantry, or whoever is supporting. You're supporting armour. He's with the brigadier, and he's with the infantry brigadier or the armoured brigadier, advising and giving support with his guns. Now, what his job is to ensure that he moves his soldiers and his batteries across the ground to give support continuously, 24 hours a day, to his infantry or his tanks. And he, of course, having been in the Essex Yeomanry as a gunner, he could do that extremely well. It came second nature to him. Not to every CO of the world, since it came along, I might add. But Arthur was good, there's no doubt about it. And he was a good personality.
Was he popular?
Yes, yeah.
So a good colonel, and you said each of them brought something. He brought this. He was particularly good at the technical liaison.
Panache and all the rest of it for Arthur. I mean, you look at him now, poor old chap, getting on a bit. But I mean, he was very much rotund, farmer figure in those days. You know, he'd been ill over the years, but he was good. Yeah, I've seen him actually line the whole of the regiment's SPs up. The back of Deer Park at Ark Hill, and run them up onto the top of the crest and fire at the target. I mean, you know, he didn't see all sorts of things like that. He thought he was a tank man, I think.
So that was him. Now, one thing I just missed, just before he took over, there was the coronation. Various things. Were you involved at all?
And
not at the castle either?
I would be at the castle, I would be firing a salute.
Do you remember it at all? Or was it just...
We did fire one or two salutes. We fired a salute to the Queen when she came to open the Royal Show in Nottingham Park. We fired one or two Royal salutes for the birth of the children.
What was a Royal salute? If you're just covering it while we think of it, we might...
41-gun salute.
Firing blanks, of course.
Yes.
Would the local populace come and watch you do it if you did it at Wollaston Park?
Yeah. Actually, we did it on the forest. Well, you wouldn't know what the forest is, but the forest is in the centre of Nottingham.
Below the cemetery?
Yes, below the cemetery. She came to see the salute fire, then she went on to the Royal Show at Wollaston. I think the coronation royal salute was done with SPs, and we had to put sleepers on the Castle Green, in order that we didn't tear that nice green turf up. That's the one, yeah.
So,
fresh grass for these royal salutes in the drill.
So, things are, we're moving into the early 50s. We ought to actually step aside momentarily and look at what happened to you. I mean, you'd come out, we haven't actually looked at your civilian career, so if we could just spend a moment on that. When you came out of the army, you were bagged immediately by the South London Hussars. Well, that's not how you made a living. What did you do?
I mean, I came out not wanting to become a chemist anymore.
My father was at Chipston's, and he said, have you ever thought about becoming a chartered surveyor? And I hadn't, but it did appeal to me to some extent, because I wanted two things. I wanted to be in the open air more than I would have been if I'd been in the forest. If I enjoyed my army experience, I wanted an out of office job. And I wanted something that was semi mathematically technical, I suppose. And he introduced me to a chartered surveyor in Nottingham who did the brewery work, and I had a month's release course time. At my last month, they were paying me in the army, and I would come up. And I went to Robert Clark, which was a firm of chartered surveyors in Nottingham, in late 49, and did a month with them, and decided to stay with them, and I was articled to the senior partner.
And that's where you had your...
That's where I became a chartered surveyor, yeah.
And you worked with them until... When did you retire?
I retired when I was 65. I'm 71 now, so 6 years ago.
So about 1994-ish. Yeah. While we're on that, so that was what was going on in the background throughout this whole period. Were they a sympathetic employer to the TA?
I had it written into my articles that I should be able to attend annual camp for the South Arts as ours.
So they were sympathetic?
Yeah.
Did they give you extra holiday for it, or did they just...
Yes. Yeah.
So would other members of the firm join the Territorials, or be encouraged to join the Territorials, or was it just you?
It was a relatively small organisation, and there weren't many of us there. But I mean, we were blessed in Nottingham with boots and players who provided a considerable number of officers over the years, and they were both sympathetic to the TA. And I think without them, we would have had a struggle to have officered up the regiment. We had a lot in at one time. We probably had three or four from boots and two or three from players at any one time. We probably had seven officers from those two firms.
Now, looking at the officers as a whole, were you aware of any division at all between the officers who might be called, using your school is actually a good example, the Nottingham High School boys, and the pre-war and perhaps some of the wartime, the public school boys, you know, the great and the good of the county, and the Birkins, that Warburton himself was of a wealthy family, that sort of thing. Were you aware of any division in the regiment?
When you join something like South Arts, you never ever consider that one day you will command it. The last thing that you think about. When I joined the South Lancers Arms, I was very happy to join the South Lancers Arms full stop. The problem about one's background didn't take place until I was possibly going to be commanding officer.
Right, well, I think we'll save that till then.
No, I mean, in the 50s and the 10 years of the 50s, I suppose, and we all got on and old with one another. There wasn't really a question, oh, he went to a public school and he didn't, he went to the high school, or he went to the military.
So it only became relevant when you were actually going to take command,
yeah.
Or possibly.
It was a very relevant factor there.
We'll come back to that then. Now, what about change subject? What about the summer camps, which seem to have been 54 West Down, 55 cancelled because of the rail strike, 56 West Down, 57 Otterburn, 58 West Down? What were the varying merits of these two camps?
There were relatively only a number of places in which you can fire 25 pounders. One of which is Stamford PTA, but that's only charged once, so that there's no real. Range to fire on, so you can forget that. There's Otterburn, Lark Hill, which is West Down in effect, because it's part of the Lark Hill ranges, and Selly Ridge, all of which were field regiment firing practice camps. Otterburn and Reedsdale, you might see Reedsdale put down. Otterburn and Reedsdale are the same place, in fact. West Down, Tilsend Lodge, and Lark Hill are virtually the same place, but there are different camps on the same train line. And there's also another one whose name escapes me now, we went to once or twice, but that's still Lark Hill. The thing that you want to be able to do on a fire is to move your batteries over a long distance over the ground in order to get this continuous ability to fire your guns over a long period of run. You also don't want to do it on bad quality ground, because you get the damn thing stuck and you have an awful job with getting the guns out of action, or even into action. And there's no doubt about it that Lark Hill, and therefore West Down, which is on Lark Hill, West Down, which is on the Lark Hill ranges, is on chalk and it dried out very quickly. Otterburn is very boggy, and it's a lot of reed grass and bog and wet and all the rest of it. So that you do have difficulty with, as you do with Sandybridge Ranges as well, which is, you know, near the Black Mountains in Wales. And so they had their own special characteristics, and also, of course, the one thing about going to camp is that the lads like a trip out, and Otterburn is a bit, well, that's not too bad for Newcastle. Lark Hill, quite good for Bournemouth and the south coast. And Sennybridge, well, that's dreadful because there's nowhere to go when you go to Sennybridge. So they all have their own particular specifications. But if you really wanted to do a really first-class exercise, which we did with Exercise Marengo in a date which I think is in there, that started at one side of the Lark Hill range and went right to the other side, and that was a whole divisional exercise, including the infantry, the artillery, everybody. And that was the last time, I think, that the Territorial Army ever did an all-arms divisional exercise in the UK.
So
that was a very exciting experience.
Tell us more about that. Would that be in Warburton's time or later? It doesn't matter really. We'll stick a date on it later. Well, tell me what it was like then, the Marengo. Why was it so exciting?
Well, it was the first time those of us who hadn't been in war had seen a total division move with all its bits and pieces, its echelons, its military police, its this, that, and the other, its infantry, its guns, its heavy guns, the signalers, everything. And we started, I think it was a four-day exercise, if I remember correctly, and we started right at the eastern side of the ranges, leaving up overnight, and then during the night moved right across the ranges to the other side, using public roads and range roads. Was a tremendous sight to see it all happen. I think that was the last time the TA ever did it.
What level of efficiency would you say the South Knots 307 manifested at these, at something like Marengo or any of the other summer camps? Both, you know, ability to be in the right place and accuracy.
The one thing that did disturb me a little bit when I first came back from 50 and regiment to the TA was that I didn't think that they were particularly efficient. Now, why they weren't particularly efficient, I wouldn't really like to comment, because a lot of them were wartime people. But I think it was just purely a question of inadequate equipment, lack of experience, but of up-to-date experience of a lot of the people that were in. There was a lot of experience historically from people who come after war, but there were also quite a lot of people with little experience. And I think that that gradually improved over the 50s by national servicemen coming in, national service officers coming in. Peter Birkin's cry for good quality potential officers. And gradually we built up our ability to carry out quite good gunnery, and culminating in the Z camp. Now, the Z camp was a camp in which the Ministry of Defence and government decided to recall wartime reservists to the TA for 1 year. And the whole regiment was made up to this war establishment with Z reservists. And we really did then see quite a considerable amount of...
Now, do you remember what year that was? I think that was...
in there somewhere.
I think it was the last year of Warburton's time.
So, probably that, yes.
What? How did they fit back in? Because it's a long time since the war by then. That was the mid-50s. There's 10 years.
I think a lot of them felt very resentful about being taken out of their civilian jobs. Because, as you quite rightly say, it was a long time off and brought back to do their old job. But by God, they didn't have to do it. Because, I mean, you've got people there. When we laid a lot of telephone lines in those days, because we couldn't rely upon the radio, particularly at night when these wireless sets virtually ceased to work at night, and used to have telephones. And these people had laid line after line for years during the war, could just lay it like that, no tomorrow, and just sort of shut up and go. It was brilliant to see them operate. And that, I think, was probably...
What about their gun drill?
Oh, they seem to cope very well, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Was it a realistic exercise? They didn't do it again, did they?
No. I don't know why they did it. I don't know why politically they did it. I don't know whether there was something... I can't tie up the year with world politics at this stage now, whether there was a reason, whether it was Berlin Airlift, or whether it was Korea, or whether it was something that triggered government off to decide whether or not it could call up reservists.